And there we go. Live on the air and up and streaming. It is 2:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 on the FM dial. Streaming live at freakradio.org. And when you go to the homepage for Freak Radio, scroll down to the little cartoon graphic of a radio tower, click on the red oval at the top of the tower. That is the valid link that will get you to Free Radio Santa Cruz streaming on the computer. And now, here's my good friend, Stuart Davis.
Was a curious boy with a wandering mind on a hungry search, undefined, in a rigid school full of concrete. A structured day and all that brought. Logic ground in repeatable facts, but big energy faded back, and they gave me far less than they stole. They packed my head and they drained my soul. So I learned to sleep in a distant stare out beyond, unaware of a clear internal path I take, and I close my eyes and fall away. Was an instant lift, my mind grew light, lucid dream of a graceful flight. Just one push and I learned to fall into the arms of the energy that voiced my call. Now each dream is an epitome, beautiful glimpse in my permanent home. I'm a timeless entity cloaked in skin, the eye of the universe turning in. And it's all between my ears. I know my way to a magic sphere, a clear internal path I take if I close my eyes and fall away. Signals laced with a lot of white noise. There's a place in me scientists can't explain, so they just dismiss.
Well, I like to think that he's my good buddy. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he is. I might not be his good buddy, but Stuart Davis, folks, of Lakeville, Minnesota. Actually, he's born in Iowa. Conceived out back behind the warehouse or some such building. Grew up in Lakeville, just south of the Twin Cities. And he's lived in Minneapolis. He's lived in Palo Alto here for a while. Stayed there anyway. But he is, by far, in my opinion, the thinking man's Weird Al Yankovic. Fantastic lyricist, and as you heard, terrific musician, and he sings and shaves his head. Stuart Davis. No, you're not tuned into the wrong show. This is indeed Monday, 3 p.m. Just in time for the new and expanded Mideast Madness. I am Ren Tawil. I'll give you the phone numbers right away since we had such good luck with them last week. Two phone lines direct to the studio. You will go on to the air right away. Area code 831 here in Santa Cruz County, California, USA. 831-427-3772. Again, 427-3772. The alternate line, number two, is 469-3119. 469-3119. I'd like to think that there was a message that's pertinent to the topic of this show, which is, of course, the Middle East conflict with a capital C. Let's just say Fall Awake, which you just heard from Stu Davis, is a inspirational tune. Couple of things right away, folks. A strong and sincere apology. Several weeks ago, I founded an email address for this program, Mideast Madness. Now, the address for that, for your emails, your messages to me, etc., is simply mideastmadness@ecomail.org. Now, like I said, the thing has been standing for several weeks now, and every time I look at it, even after I refresh the page, the inbox page, it keeps saying there is no mail in this inbox, or there is no mail in this at this location. So I decided to send a test email from my account and from another private account to mideastmadness@ecomail.org. Neither of them came through. I sent a special email to the only support address that I could find for Ecomail, and explaining the problem. I got a message within 24 hours, and the guy simply said, unceremoniously, "I see messages there in your inbox." Again, he said, "I see messages there in your inbox." So I go back to my email, and I'm trying all this stuff. I'm constantly refreshing the page. I'm looking at all the options and changing things, going from default conditions to non-default, nothing. Refreshing pages doesn't work. The help section doesn't work. I'm simply not seeing anything in the inbox. So I whip up another email to send to the same address, support address, supposedly, at Ecomail, and something weird happened, as it often does when I'm on the keyboard there, and I wasn't sure what happened. I wasn't sure if it was sent or if I lost it. Now, I thought I had reacquired it, but the next day I look and it was, according to the features on my personal email account, it was never sent. So that's three more days wasted. I went back and rewrote it from memory, describing to the guy the fact that it's just not working. Can you help me? And in this second message, or this last message, I says to the guy, "Hey, at the very least, I'd like to be able to retrieve the messages that I got." Now, it's possible that the only messages on the account were those two test messages that I sent, but there may be more. And herein is my apology. If there was even a single person or any number of people who tried to get in touch with me through my ecomail.org address, 1,000 pardons. I'm sorry, sorry, so sorry. I have not been ignoring you. I ain't chicken. I simply have not been aware that people have been sending to that address, because it appears to be a bogus address. And as far as I'm concerned, Ecomail is a bogus service. Could be a problem on my end. I'm not totally computer literate, even after some 13, 14 years. I might have some filter problem or some other setup problem. If anyone, by the way, out there is familiar with the Ecomail service, give me a call. Give me a hint, anything, something to go on. Because, as I said in that final letter to the guys, hey, I want to retrieve all these messages so they're not lost forever in cyberspace. But in either event, whether they do or not, I may change. If I get the messages with the help from this support team, as it were, then I will respond to them finally. And I may retain the service. If I don't get help from these guys and if it doesn't work, I'm simply going to have to reestablish another email address for Mideast Madness. So again, I feel really bad and very tardy about tending to this. I think I should have sent those test emails out a lot earlier. But if you've been trying to get in touch with me through email, that's what's going on, folks. I'm not ignoring you. Don't feel small. Don't feel insulted. I am dealing with the situation. And next week, there's a very good chance that I will have another email address, a second one, a valid one that I will have tested if I can find a service that I like. Okay. Please keep that in mind if you want to send something or help me with this problem. Another bit of interesting news. Some 10, 11, 12 months ago, I had an idea. Why not? Okay, I'm an Arab American. All right, in fact, I'm a Palestinian Arab American. Or a Palestinian American. Or an American Palestinian. Depends on how you want to look at it. At any rate, you know, my father, he's from, he was born in 1915 in Jerusalem, grew up there, eventually had a hardware business, two stores in Jerusalem and in Haifa. Now, he lost those properties and all the wealth that he had that he left at home. He went to the United States on business, both family and business, when things started popping in the middle of May, 1948. And the State of Israel came about in their so-called War of Independence, which is a misnomer, by the way, hardly independence. And he, my dad, could not return. He could not return to Israel, Palestine, whichever you want to call it, or Jerusalem, and claim his goods and continue with the life that he and his business partner, his brother, had made for themselves. They even took his brother. He was killed by Zionist partisans, shot because his brother Wadia tried to go back to the warehouse in Jerusalem to claim his goods, to claim his property, and validate that, and they shot him, they killed him. But we all have our horror stories, don't we? So, about getting back to that idea I was speaking about 2 minutes ago, some 10, 12 months ago, I thought, look, I've been to the Gaza Strip back in 08, I've done this and I've done that. I helped found the Palestinian participation at the Minnesota Festival of Nations in St. Paul back in 80. Attended meetings, attended parties, hoflies, done all kinds of things. But I think what it's going to take to get people thinking and talking about this issue, about the big capital C conflict out there, is I'm just going to make a sign, beautiful sign, a couple of them, so I could fashion it into a sandwich board and walk up and down Pacific Avenue here in downtown Santa Cruz or wherever else I feel I'm needed, and I'll get a reaction or polite response anyway. And the sign's just going to say, please talk to me about Israelis and Arabs, with the word peace at the bottom. So I went out and spent a lot of money and had a professional calligrapher make up the sign. She did an excellent job. It's pretty. Very nice to look at. And I think it's inviting to most people. It certainly gets their attention. And I'm walking up and down this Pacific Avenue with this, wearing this sandwich board today, which was the second time. I did it last Wednesday, too, for a little over an hour. I didn't even make it to 1 hour today. I was late in leaving the house, and I had to come by here to crank up the show. And people's reactions, by far, were polite. They were all polite. As you could imagine, there were many, many, I mean, like countless peculiar stares from people. Generally what happens is they read the sign for 2 seconds, and then maybe they'll look me in the eye for a couple more seconds. They may or may not smile, and they go on. Well, I don't know what they're thinking, but there were also the instances where people were willing to talk to me. And I told them the truth, the absolute truth. I'm out there trying to promote dialogue about the Middle East conflict, about Arabs, Israelis, Jews, Muslims, Palestinians. Because, for one thing, obviously there's not a whole lot of talk, constructive inter-talk between the adversarial parties. Not enough to make the thing go anywhere. So, if nothing more, we can get the talk going here. I mean, after all, taxpayer gives, we taxpayers collectively in the USA dish out over $3 billion per year to the Israeli military budget. And an amount close to that, but less, to Egypt. And that's really just to maintain an even playing field there so we can make friends with everyone, right? You know, be nice by everyone who we consider to be strategically important or economically important. And, of course, there is USAID that gives to the various Arab nations. We, the taxpayer, even give to the Palestinian Authority, which has just changed its name officially, by the way. Point is, folks, we Americans are intrinsically involved in what goes on over there. So here I am walking up and down the street with this sandwich board, asking people, trying to stand up straight, holding my head up high, not in any kind of braggadocio, but smiling, you know, just trying to look as approachable as I can. I even shaved yesterday. So here I am trying to look approachable and friendly and open. And last Wednesday, when I tried this for the first time, I had some half dozen discussions with people. As I said, everyone was polite and civil. One of the discussions was adversarial. A gentleman who said that he was once a hippie who hated the police, hated the man, as he put it, but now he is a Republican. Didn't look like a stereotypical Republican, and he even admitted that to me. You know, he was kind of big and burly and had some, was unshaven by a few days. Looked like he could have been a homeless person. I never ascertained whether he was or not, but that's really not important, is it? But he says he's a Republican, and the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have to stop attacking Israel. And he gave, you know, as so often is the case, he dished out these factoids to me about what the Muslims are really like and the awful things that Muslim Arabs say about Jews. And, you know, I'm not saying these things are not true, but I tried to point out to him this is the reason why there is no peace in the Middle East, is people adhere to these positions that they're coming from, often positions of bitterness and confrontation and hostility or defense against hostility. And each side acting as if either it has all the answers or that it is truly the victim in this conflict and that the other side should leave them alone. And they both do that. Israel says that it's been the victim since 1948 of Arab aggression, even though there's far, far more to that story that they don't tell you or probably not aware of. And the Palestinians, who I freely admit I believe are the ones who are actually getting the short end of the stick, the Palestinians also lay claim to the label of victimhood. So, that was me, folks, walking up and down the street in downtown Santa Cruz, and you will see me again there with my sandwich sign. I'm going to make the most of it. And now, kiddies, for today's readings. I mentioned a few moments ago. Come on, computer screen. You blanked out on me. I need you to come back. Give the full Monty there. Okay, you're showing yourself. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Palestinian Authority, and it's always bugged me that they're forced to say Palestinian Authority as opposed to Palestine Authority. Because obviously, Israel would never go for the word Palestine, as infers an actual place with formally recognized legitimacy. It has to be, by the Israelis, it has to be the Palestinian Authority. Well, I have something here from Haaretz that very widely distributed, and I think rather wonderful publication in Israel. Haaretz, January 5, 2012. Obviously, that's 2013. Palestinian Authority officially changes name to State of Palestine. So, they are no longer officially the Palestinian Authority. They changed their name to the State of Palestine. And, of course, this follows their efforts at the United Nations, their successful efforts this year, to get recognition as a non-member state. The overwhelming majority of the General Assembly of the United Nations said yes. United States and Israel, of course, both nations said no. U.S. might have abstained, but I doubt that they would. I don't think Israel would have stand for such an abstention from the U.S. Probably voted no. And beyond that, the United States not only said no, but they have they announced that they were going to effectively punish this new state of Palestine by withholding support funds. Which really makes a lot of sense, folks, right? I mean, their economy is in the dumps because as Mitt Romney would try to convince you, it's in their culture. The Arabs don't have as good a culture as the Israelis do. They only have foreign troops crawling all over the occupied territories and surrounding and impinging the Gaza Strip, making life miserable for them. And Palestinians cannot operate a normal economy under such conditions. There's all kinds of military government restrictions. Things take a lot of time. But no, it's the culture of the Palestinian Arabs. Okay, getting back to the thing here. The actual title is Palestinian Authority officially changes name to State of Palestine. Abbas signs presidential decree in first concrete move after successful UN bid. Meanwhile, Gaza health official says more than 55 injured, one dead, after Fatah rally is overcrowded, marred with violence. Again, this is from the Israeli publication periodical Haaretz, January 5. Which would have been last Saturday, 2 days ago. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas signed a presidential decree on Friday, officially changing the name of the Palestinian Authority to the, quote, State of Palestine, end quote. All Palestinian stamps, signs, and official letterhead will henceforth be changed to bear the new name, according to the official Palestinian news agency, Wafa. The move marked the first concrete, albeit symbolic, step the Palestinians have taken following the November decision by the United Nations to upgrade their status to a non-member observer state. Abbas, who has enjoyed a boost in his status since the successful bid at the United Nations, has hesitated to take more dramatic steps, like filing war crimes indictments against Israel at the International Criminal Court, a tactic that only a recognized state can carry out. In other words, let me butt in here, the current status of the former PA is in the UN is as a non-member observer state, but they are a state, which technically means they are free to file such war crimes indictments against Israel at the International Criminal Court. Okay, continuing. Also on Friday, tens of thousands of Fatah supporters rallied in the Hamas stronghold of Gaza for the first time since they were routed from power there by the Islamist militants in 2007. So this is Fatah in the Gaza Strip. Fatah, a longtime arch enemy, as it were, expressed in the most militant of terms, of Hamas. Continuing, the rally, approved by Gaza's Hamas rulers, marks a renewed attempt by the rival Palestinian factions to show unity following a fierce Hamas battle with Israel in November and Fatah's recognition bid at the United Nations. Hamas gained new support among Palestinians following 8 days of fighting with Israel in November, during which Israel pounded the seaside strip from the air and sea, while Palestinian militants lobbed rockets toward Israel, including toward the cities of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv for the first time. Following the fighting, Fatah allowed Hamas to hold its first rally in the West Bank, where Fatah is politically dominant, since the 2007 split. Hamas returned the favor Friday by allowing the Fatah rally to take place. The two sides still have wide differences, chief among them how to deal with Israel. In addition, several rounds of reconciliation talks over recent years centered on finding ways to share power failed to yield results. Both sides expressed optimism following Friday's unprecedented Fatah show of strength that included hours of waving their yellow flags, dancing in the streets, and chanting party slogans. For years, Fatah loyalists in Gaza faced retribution from the Hamas regime, which banned them from gathering. "We feel like birds freed from our cage today," said Fadwa Talib, 46, who worked as a police officer for Fatah before the Hamas takeover and attended Friday's rally with her family. "We are happy and feel powerful again." Top Fatah officials arrived in Gaza for the first time since they were violently ousted. Abbas, who rules the West Bank, did not attend the event, but he addressed the crowd on a large screen, telling them there is no substitute for national unity. And it is 3:30 p.m. here in Santa Cruz County, California. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org. Continuing. Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh also expressed hope that the two factions could reconcile their differences, sending Fatah a message that he hoped they could work together as joint representatives of the Palestinian people, according to Fatah official Nabil Shath. Hamas was not directly involved in the event. Ihab al-Ghusyan, the chief spokesman for the Hamas government in Gaza, said the sides would, quote, work toward the consolidation of national unity, end quote. Egyptian officials say first such meeting in months between the factions is scheduled for next week in Cairo. Cairo is the capital city of Egypt. After the rally, Haniyeh called Abbas to congratulate him, and Abbas in turn thanked Haniyeh for letting it happen, and Haniyeh spokesman said Haniyeh spokesman Tahir al-Nunu. He added that both leaders expressed hope that the cooperation would lead to renewed conciliation efforts. Still, the two sides have wide differences over Israel and over the possibility of sharing power. Fatah has held several rounds of peace talks with the Jewish state and says it is committed to a two-state solution. Hamas does not recognize Israel and is officially committed to its destruction. So says this article from Haaretz. Hamas has carried out hundreds of deadly attacks against Israeli civilians and is regarded by the United States and Israel as a terrorist organization. Now, I must break in here again. In terms of any details about military strikes of one side on the other, how often does anyone hear about anything other than the Gaza Strip firing their rockets and mortars against Israeli civilians? I admit it is a war crime, technically, because they're firing upon citizens. But again, how often does anyone hear any details other than those missiles? I mentioned earlier I was in the Gaza Strip 4 years ago. 5 years ago. Actually, 4.5 years ago. August of 2008. For about a week. I think it was a little more than a week. I saw the living conditions, the dire situation that the people suffer from, the lack of spare parts for equipment in their hospitals, including kidney dialysis machines. So they were down to like two or three machines when I was there that were functioning. the pollution of the water, because Israel restricts and often forbids. Shipment of replacement parts for infrastructure, the civilian infrastructure in city of Gaza and elsewhere in the Gaza Strip. And, okay, so you may say, well, that's not military. You want to know what military is? The two major strikes, invasions, in reality massacres that Israel perpetrated on the Gazans in December and January of 2008, 2009, and this most recent one 2 months ago, were not, I repeat, were not an example of how Israel will put its foot down after great restraint, quote-unquote. The Israelis want the world, particularly the United States, to believe that Israel does nothing to hurt the Palestinians. Therefore, the two strikes were necessitated. BS, folks. It's bull. I didn't see any military action with my own two eyes. There were no explosions. There was no war going on during the time that I was there. But I have friends who were with me on the voyage, our successful embarkation from Larnaca, Cyprus, into the port of Gaza. Some of them chose to stay. And I've received dispatches from them and from many other sources saying how the IDF fires upon farmers, unarmed people just trying to work in their fields and in their gardens, fires rifles and sometimes shoots and kills people, including children. And it's not always across the line from Israel. These guys, these IDF soldiers, they come in whenever they like across the border in their jeeps and in their tanks. There have been many, many instances of Israel agitating the situation by incurring into the Gaza Strip in tanks and in full military force, the infantry, foot soldiers, going in, wreaking havoc, killing unarmed civilians. In a few instances, armed Palestinians, members of the police force, or militants will shoot back when they can. But in many cases, the Arabs show up with their rifles and small arms, the IDF has come in, done its damage, and left. Strike forces, which constantly make life hell for the people who live there. This goes on, this has been going on week after week before the massacre in 2008, and probably has been happening quite a bit too between the wars, the so-called Gaza wars. All right, let's get back to the article. I was addressing what it said in the article about Hamas has carried out hundreds of deadly attacks against Israeli citizens with its missiles and mortars and is regarded by the United States and Israel as a terrorist organization. Folks, terror is terror. Whether it's perpetrated by small, shadowy militant groups or much, much more powerful and much richer military organizations of established governments. War is terrorism, but with a bigger budget, is what it comes down to. Terrorism is ultimately defined as the terror it inflicts upon those against whom it's perpetrated. All right. Back to the article. After the rally... Wait a minute. Okay. Hamas political chief Khaled Meshal, considered more pragmatic than the movement's Gaza-based hardline leaders, forged a reconciliation agreement with Abbas in 2011. But the Gaza-based leadership has held up implementing it and has blamed Fatah of doing the same. Fatah enjoys Western support and has been pressured not to forge a unity agreement with the militant Hamas, facing a potential cutback in foreign aid if it does. Friday's rally also served as a reminder of the conflicts within Fatah itself that continue to dog the movement. Officials canceled the events halfway through after 20 people were injured due to overcrowding and shoving matches erupted between separate Fatah factions. Yahya Rabah, a top Fatah official in Gaza, said the rally was canceled, quote, due to the huge number of participants and logistical failures. But witnesses said one pushing match was between supporters of Abbas and partisans of Fatah's former Gaza security commander, Mohammed Dahlan, who was expelled from the party because of conflicts with Abbas. Another Fatah official, who spoke anonymously because he did not want to embarrass the party, said the rally was canceled because hundreds of Dahlan supporters jumped up on the stage and clashed with Abbas supporters. Fatah spokesman Fayez Abu Etta attributed the injuries to overcrowding and the excitement of the rally. Later, more Palestinians were injured when part of a stage collapsed. Youths also clashed and stabbings were reported. Gaza health official Ashraf Al-Kidra said overall 55 people were injured, including three critically. There was one death during the rally. A 23-year-old Fatah activist was electrocuted while trying to hang a flag on an electric pole. Overnight, throngs had camped out in a downtown Gaza square to ensure themselves a spot for the anniversary commemoration of Fatah's 1965 founding. And tens of thousands marched early Friday carrying Fatah banners. When the rally began, people stampeded to the stage to try to shake leaders' hands. I do believe this is the full article from Haaretz. You can see it online at www.haaretz, that's HAARETZ.com. /news/Middle East with a hyphen / Palestinian Authority officially changes name to State of Palestine. Just go to the Haaretz website and look for Palestinian Authority officially changes name to State of Palestine. Well, no one can say that I am entirely adverse to reading over the air reports of bad things that the Arabs do, that the Palestinians do, namely shove one another and have physical fights and spats and do stupid things like get themselves electrocuted. So the article from this Israeli paper gives fairly short focus on the name change, but mostly talks about the status of relations between Hamas and Fatah, of Mr. Haniyeh and Mr. Abbas. And all this infighting. As I was growing up, one of the biggest arguments that I heard from people who dismiss the Arabs as impossible to work with because they're fighting each other all the time. Well, yes, there is a history of that, of Arabs fighting Arabs. Just as there is a history of some Jews occasionally fighting Jews. But in the case of the conflict, there's a phrase I'm sure you've all heard, most of you. Divide and conquer. Now, I've talked about this before on the show. And this show is Mideast Madness, coming to you from Free Radio Santa Cruz every Monday at 3 o'clock for about 2 hours. Free Radio Santa Cruz is 3:45 Pacific Standard Time. Yes, I have spoken about divide and conquer. And that's my view, my personal view, about one of the weapons the Israelis use to frustrate and effectively sabotage progress in the Palestinian camp. Because they know the harder they make it for the Palestinians to function, even when they're taking nonviolent actions, even when they're trying to be diplomatic, Israel doesn't come through on something they promise. They often, really very often, break ceasefires themselves, the Israelis do. And perform all kinds of political mischief against the Pals. And partly as a result of that, in their frustration and their desperation, individuals within a particular political party and or militant group end up at each other's throats in terms of how to deal with Israel, because nothing seems to work. And some of them have real big ideas and real big personalities, and they eventually emerge, admittedly after much violence. But again, this is out of desperation. And here are the Israelis and the U.S. government sometimes, even our own presidents, like Ronald Reagan, have poo-pooed the Palestinians by saying they don't even get along with themselves. Despite the denials of freedom, political rights, of the Palestinians who live in the occupied territories, and even restrictions against so-called equal Arab Israelis in Israel proper, denial of rights or apartheid status that they suffer. And yes, apartheid is very real in Israel, in the state of Israel, of Jews over Arabs. And yes, folks, I do get off on tangents, and I tend to lose my track, my train of thought. But as Israel continues to carry out these actions to fluster Palestinian attempts to do good for themselves and do good for their neighbors, it's divide and conquer. Mess up the other side by inspiring infighting. Which supposedly justifies continued military restraint by the Israeli Defense Forces, who, as you know, I prefer to call the IDF the IOF, the Israeli Occupation Forces, because that's what they are. One thing in name, officially, something else in reality. Israeli Occupation Forces. Again, the phone numbers here are area code 831-427-3772 and 469-3119. My thanks to the two individuals who called me with their very amiable and welcomed phone calls last Monday. Betsy? Or is it Betty? I'm sorry. And Robert from San Diego. I hope you're listening still. You're welcome to call me again. Any of you are certainly welcomed and encouraged to call. You may say whatever you think is appropriate about what I'm telling people over the airwaves and around the world via the internet. Okay. Where's the other one? Here it is. In my attempts to research using the net, as you can imagine, I come across a lot of stuff. It was only a matter of time, I think, before I would discover Op-Ed News. Name is familiar. I've obviously heard of them before, but the Op-Ed News website, they admit that they are a catalyst for progressive change and feature progressive liberal writers. That's Op-Ed News. And, you know, with a name like that and those circumstances, as you can imagine, they're going to have all kinds of people writing in stuff and sending in stuff. And probably most of those people are of little or no renown in a social sense for the things that they speak of. But some of them do. Here's a really long piece. But I'm going to try to get through it, hopefully by 4 o'clock, which would wrap up the first half of Mideast Madness, which comes to you every Monday on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 p.m., 1500 hours. Indeed. Stephen Lendman, or maybe it's Stephen Lendman, lives in Chicago and can be reached at email address removed. Okay, I should have crossed that out. For whatever reason, they removed it. He removed it. His new book is titled Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity. So the guy is an author, or something of an author. Here's a website, www.claritypress.com, claritypress.com/Lendman, capital I dot html. Visit his blog site at sjlendman.blogspot.com and listen to cutting-edge discussions with distinguished guests on the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, Thursdays at 10 a.m. United States Central Time, and Saturdays and Sundays at noon. All programs are archived for easy listening. I will repeat those details later. Stephen Lendman says, I was born in 1934, am a retired progressive small businessman concerned about all the major national and world issues, committed to speak out and write about them. Mr. Lendman is the author of his piece, No Relief for Palestine in New Year. Subtitled, Israel Terrorizes Palestine, by Stephen Lendman. From January 2nd of 2013, by the way. Gaza remains isolated under siege. No relief in sight looms. Occupation harshness is policy. Peace is a four-letter word. See, that's funny because peace is spelled P-E-A-C-E. It's five letters, but he calls it a four-letter word. I don't think that's because he's illiterate. It's speaking and rhetorical. Anyway, back to the article. Dominant Israeli hardliners scorn it. So does Washington. Violence and instability advance their agenda. Conflict will continue in 2013. So will Palestinian suffering. Settlement construction continues unabated. Netanyahu wants it accelerated. He wants all valued parts of Judea and Samaria under Israeli control. And by valued parts, most likely they're talking about the most arable land, the least desert-like, in the semi-arid area of historic Palestine. Returning to article, Jerusalem is Israel's exclusive capital, he insists. His notion of Palestinian self-determination is none at all. Rhetorically, he claims otherwise. On January 1, Israel National News headlined, Netanyahu stands behind Palestinian state vision. Palestine, of course, achieved statehood in November 1988. 1988, folks. Netanyahu has his own vision. It's conditional on, quote, a public, binding, and unequivocal Palestinian recognition of Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people, end quote. He insists Palestinians must recognize Jerusalem as Israel's exclusive capital. Behave like good little boys and girls, he insists. Obey your Israeli master. Only Jews have rights. Do what we say or else is policy. Mahmoud Abbas is enforcer. He's well compensated for services rendered. There'll be no third intifada as long as he's president, he says. Mr. Netanyahu says. He scorns resistance. He deplores liberation. He supports surrendering most of Palestine to Israel. Marwan Barghouti is a legitimate Palestinian leader. He's Palestine's most popular one. He's a prisoner of conscience. He was incarcerated on fraudulent charges. If allowed to run for president, he'd win overwhelmingly. Imprisoning him for life prevents it. On December 26, he was interviewed. Marwan Barghouti was interviewed. Israel's Channel 10 did so for the first time. He warned that if occupation continues, a third intifada looms. It'll be a popular, nonviolent one, he said. If he was Palestine's president, he'd support it. Barghouti called Abbas a comfortable Israeli partner. He said Israel spurns peace. He believes resistance is essential. Change won't come any other way. And Iran will add, resistance is not essentially violent. Resistance is not necessarily violence. We've all heard about civil disobedience in this country. There's been more and more such civil disobedience being practiced in Israel by Arabs and those who support the Palestinian Israelis and by the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Returning, he believes resistance is essential. Change won't come any other way. Abbas is a longtime Israeli collaborator. He provides enforcer services. He governs illegitimately. He usurped West Bank coup d'etat power. His presidential term expired in January 09. Abbas spurns new elections. In October, sham municipal ones were held. They were the first since 2005. Democracy wasn't on the ballot. Legitimate choice was excluded. Half or more eligible voters stayed home. Low turnout revealed widespread apathy. Why support officials serving Israel? Abbas rigged things for them. Hamas opted out. A spokesman said, our supporters understand that we are not participating, and therefore we expect them not to vote for anyone. Fatah independent candidates were excluded. Pro-Israeli ones ran virtually unopposed. Abbas spurns general elections. He wanted local West Bank ones to renew Fatah support. Results left egg on his face. Palestinians are stuck with him as long as he stays president. Like-minded pro-Israeli stooges await to replace him when he steps down. And once again, folks, this was written by Mr. Stefan Ledman, who has his own blog. Yes, he is the author of at least one book, but I admit he does have a somewhat rambling style, short, succinct, one-liners all kind of strung together. That's my evaluation of his writing anyway. You do have to pay close attention to this to understand every sentence here for exactly what it says. It almost sounds like there are contradictions here, but it's a blog, folks. It's effectively part of his blog, and it was selected by Op-Ed News as a feature selection. This is entitled "No Relief for Palestine in the New Year," from January 2nd this year. Back to the article. Ayub Shmamasne lives in Harun, Sheikh Jarrah. His plight reflects thousands of other Palestinians. They're victims of Israeli ethnic cleansing. They live on land Israel wants. State authorities can't claim it legally. They steal it instead. To whom it may concern, he wrote. His family is threatened. He's lived in his home since 1964. He and his wife raised six children. In 2009, Israel's general custodian told him his rental agreement won't be renewed. Israeli authorities sued him, quote, to take ownership of his property via individuals they claim are descendants of pre-1948 original Jewish owners. Again, that's Israeli authorities sued Mr. Shmamasne to take ownership of his property via individuals they claim are descendants of original Jewish owners dating back before the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. Two judicial hearings were held. Evidence proving nearly 40 years of legitimate residency was dismissed out of hand. Leave by December 31 or before stout, he was told. As far as we know, he said, the property will be handed over to a right-wing settler organization that has previously taken over properties in the neighborhood. Israeli law reflects double standard illegitimacy. Palestinian land is stolen for Jewish development. We are about to lose our home and be thrown out onto the street, he said. Forced eviction will not only be a human tragedy, but also a political maneuver to strengthen and expedite, end quote, East Jerusalem settlement expansions. He called on readers and concerned people worldwide for support. Ongoing evictions affects others. On December 31st, around 1,000 Palestinians got eviction orders. Israel wants their land for military purposes. Wadi Male, Ain Hilwan, Wadi Al-Faw, Al-Maita, Al-Burj, and other Jordan Valley areas are affected. On December 6th, the Hamokid Center for the Defense of the Individual said from 1967 to 1994, quote, Israel revoked the residency of some 250,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Some 250,000, 250,000 Palestinians. Now, author Stephen Lendman says here, I was born in 1934. am a retired progressive small businessman concerned about all the major national and world news, world issues, committed to speak out and write about them. Another 14,000 East Jerusalemites. Okay, I think there was... Apparently I made a mistake in the printing up of this article. Please forgive the redundancy. Okay, as I was saying, on December 6th, the Hamokin Center for the Defense of the Individual said from 1967 to 1994, Israel revoked the residency of some 250,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and from the Gaza Strip. Another 14,000 East Jerusalemites were affected. Without notice or judicial review, Palestinian land was stolen. Thousands lost their residency status. Homeland rights were lost. On January 1, Man News headlined, "A precarious existence in the Jordan Valley is home to some of Palestine's most fertile land. Most Palestinians there are impoverished. Basic infrastructure is lacking. The entire valley reflects, quote, a patchwork of zones in which Palestinians are allowed to live," end quote. "They have little room for maneuver." According to United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs head Ramesh Rajasingham, quote, "These restrictions have removed their ability to be self-sustaining. They are in an artificial humanitarian crisis. They have the capacity, the training, the education, but because of man-made restrictions, they are made vulnerable." The legitimate rights are denied. Israel stole their land. It's, quote, marked as closed military zones and nature reserves. I guess nature is more important than the people. An additional 50% is controlled by settlers. Practically nothing remains for them, for the Palestinians. Other restrictions reinforce their exclusion. Oslo designated 90% of valley land Area C. Israel maintains full civil and military control. Palestinians are largely shut out of land rightfully theirs. They're denied sufficient clean water and other essential services. Settler needs are prioritized. Multiple Israeli military bases occupy Jordan Valley land. They terrorize Palestinian residents. They're called, quote, intruders on their own property. The Palestinians are called intruders. They're disposed of what's rightfully theirs. One resident said, quote, "The army came and said, if you don't leave, we will demolish your houses. You must leave to Tayasir. It's far from here," end quote. Palestinians have no choice. Leave or be forced out. Eviction orders are served regularly. A, quote, "general environment of fear and uncertainty, particularly among children," end quote, affects everyone. Palestinians living in or near military firing zones are most affected. They have little access to services such as health care and education, and no basic utilities like electricity and sanitation. Building on their own land is prohibited by Israel. Doing so assures demolitions and fines. Settlers get financial help on stolen Palestinian land. They're encouraged to take full advantage. Israel wants Jordan Valley Palestinians out. It wants total area control. Resident rights are spurned. Growing numbers are impoverished. They hang on best they can. They struggle to retain what's rightfully theirs. On December 30th, Mondawise contributor Annie Robbins headlined, "Rising right wing in Israel is using violent provocation in West Bank to push annexation." Settler violence continues to escalate on a daily basis. Israel practically encourages it. Nothing is done to stop it. Settlement construction facilitates land theft. Palestinian dispossessions accompany it. Abbas rhetorically complains. Threats about dismantling the PA, Palestinian Authority, if it continues, handing Netanyahu the keys to presidential headquarters and threatening ICC action, International Court of Justice, if diplomatic stalemate continues, ring hollow. So I'll reread that rather clumsily rendered paragraph to you. Abbas rhetorically complains. Threats about dismantling the Palestinian Authority, if it continues, handing Netanyahu the keys to presidential headquarters and threatening international criminal court action if diplomatic stalemate continues, ring hollow. At the same time, unprovoked Israeli attacks, quote, continue unabated in the West Bank. The General Assembly, quote, adopted 9 resolutions condemning them. Policies with teeth don't follow. Israel remains unaccountable. Abbas's bluster without bite. He's not about to confront the hand that feeds him. He nears retirement. He amassed enormous stolen wealth. He wants to live comfortably when he steps down unharassed. Acquiescing to Israeli harshness assures it. His enforcer services, rigged elections, and opposition to legitimate intifada resistance shows where he stands. He'll do nothing to block growing annexation of Palestinian land. He talks, but stops short of acting. He's not about to lose everything he gained. A final comment. East Jerusalem's Isawiya village residents face unconscionable Israeli repression. They're a microcosm of an institutionalized collective punishment. In recent weeks, dozens were arrested. They've been brutally treated. Tensions escalated after Samer Isawi's arrest. He's a Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP activist. He was imprisoned for 10 years. Last October, he was freed with others in exchange for Gilad Shalit. Allow me to break in. Gilad Shalit was the Israeli soldier who was captured, or as the Israelis like to insist, kidnapped, by Hamas militants, I believe it was Hamas militants, several years ago. And after many false starts and clumsy attempts at negotiations, Hamas finally released Shalit for, I think it was 2,000 Palestinians who the Israelis had incarcerated, returning. In July, Israel rearrested Isawi. He was bogusly charged. In August, he hunger struck for justice. His condition deteriorated. Village residents support him. A solidarity march was organized. Clashes followed. So did mass arrests. At least 17 children were targeted. Security forces terrorize village residents daily. Hani Isawi lives in Isawahi. There's an intifada here, he says, but it's by police, not residents. In the past few days, there have been no demonstrations, no marches, nothing only police provocations. Jerusalem police deny clear evidence of state-sponsored viciousness. Victims are blamed for Israeli crimes. Yisui he reflects Palestine. Justice delay denies it. Liberation struggles continue. It has long, painful miles to go. Again, this was an entry to the Op-Ed News website, Op-Ed News, by Stephen Lendman, or Stephen Lendman, retired college, as he puts it, progressive small businessman. Now, those who have heard my show before can attest to the fact that I almost always, well, no, I won't say almost always, but at least half of the time I will read from news dispatches, from sources that can be backed up and verified. I do occasionally read essays and opinions. And this clearly is an opinion by a concerned American citizen about various world affairs. And as I said a little bit ago, yes, it's full of these tiny little sentences which paint a harsh, bitter picture of life in the occupied territories. Well, we all know that life in the territories is difficult for the Palestinians. Israeli military and police run rampant. They take what they want. Sometimes without the proper papers, permits, and permissions from Jerusalem, they just take. Mr. Lendman, in my opinion, is not the best writer. He does string these short ideas together. And again, because this is not an official news dispatch, I wish I could verify or invalidate a number of the things that he says here. At any rate, you can do that too. If you hear me out there, call me at 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. If you would like your opinion to be heard. If you do not have answers as such, perhaps you have questions. Maybe you have something to say about this program in general, or about me in particular. I encourage you to call in. If you don't call in, it will only be my voice you continue to hear. Well, I'm going to go ahead and read this here. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is a global organization with an office, franchise, as it were, here in Santa Cruz County. Santa Cruz Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF, puts out The Undaunted Dove, a newsletter of their activities and opinions, researches. There is an article by Margaret Knight. Shalom, Salam, Peace, Reports of the Middle East Cluster. Again, this is from The Undaunted Dove. You'd think they'd have a date on the cover. Looks pretty, like pretty new paper here. Probably the most recent Undaunted Dove. Here we go. Hang on, folks. Grabbing another refreshing beverage here, which I just spilled all over myself. I'll be there in a minute. Just a minute. Huh? Actually, you know what? It's 19 minutes after 4. 1619 hours. I have another announcement. There's an event happening tonight at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, address 612 Ocean Street in downtown Santa Cruz. It begins at 6:30 at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. The only thing is, I need to grab the, let's see here. Oh, someone's knocking at my door. Stand by, I'll keep the mic open. Who is it?
Say again?
Wrong number, folks. I'm sorry about that. But I don't mind the visit. That almost never happens. Someone knocks on the door, on the studio door, in the middle of my my show here. Probably another programmer. Thought somebody else was going to be here. See, even with the old show, I would have been here during this time anyway. I used to start at 4 and go to 4:55. Now we start the show at 3 p.m. every Monday and go to 4:55. So I do not understand why he expected to see someone else. Okay. Getting back to my very clumsy... attempt to pass on this public service announcement. Need to get to my own Hotmail account in order to do that for you. As I was saying, so a guy will be speaking tonight at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, Santa Cruz, City of Santa Cruz, California. Please forgive me for having neglected to set this up before I began the show. And put my password in here. It's called Five Broken Cameras. That is the presentation this evening at RCNV. Hello? Yeah, my lights are bouncing. And here are the details. It's a movie, folks. Tonight, the Palestine-Israel Action Committee, a division of Resource Center for Nonviolence, will be showing the movie Five Broken Cameras at the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 6:30 p.m., half past six. This documentary film is getting excellent reviews and is being considered for an Oscar nomination, I imagine, in the foreign film category. Also, the brother, Iyad Bernat, one of the filmmakers, will be visiting the University of California campus here at Santa Cruz on Wednesday. We hope to see you there. Sami Abed, PIAC. Now, again, this evening, Monday, January 7, is the showing of the movie at 612 Ocean Street. The former Christian Science Church, I believe it was. Now it's been taken over by RCNV. The movie's tonight, the documentary, and tomorrow evening, or tomorrow, I don't have the details, but, or not, no, I'm sorry, not tomorrow, Wednesday, January 9th, the brother of the man behind the film, Iyad Barnat, is the name of the brother, one of the filmmakers will be visiting UC campus at Santa Cruz, UCSC campus on Wednesday. And there's a rather attractive but somewhat hard to read tiny rendition of the poster, Five Broken Cameras, a film by someone Barnat and someone else. It says, one of the reviews is quoted here, powerful, .. an unflinching review of the Palestinian experience. And eye-opening, proudly defiant, a work that captures so many largely unreported details. In cinemas, 19 October. I've only recently heard of it. But again, this evening at 6:30 p.m., we will be screening the film. RCNV will be screening the film. I happen to be a member of Resource Center for Nonviolence. 612 Ocean Street. A donation of $5 to $10 is asked. $5 to $10, folks. Well, compare that to your typical commercial theater admission price. Not bad. Generally, I would say easily cheaper. And this is being presented by the Palestine-Israel Action Committee. www.PalestineIsraelActionCommittee.org. Okay, there's the announcement for Five Broken Cameras. And now I can return to the Wilf newsletter I was reading. It's 4:26, by the way. Just a minute short of a half hour remaining on this week's Mideast Madness. I'm Ren Tawil. Please consider donating to Free Radio Santa Cruz if you want to keep the service on the air. I would certainly appreciate your allowing me to continue my service, my program. Send what you can. We're asking people to supplement the programmer's dues. We have to pay by the month. All programmers pay on a monthly basis to do their show. Otherwise, they get canned and put off the air. But that's okay. Supplement our donations and send something, please. Send a donation to FRSC. Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Again, that's FRSC for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, C-R-U-Z, California, 95061. And yes, FRSC still needs a new studio near downtown Santa Cruz with 24-hour access and a bathroom. We're looking for about 150 square feet. Don't want to pay more than $300 a month, preferably less. Such a move would definitely seriously improve our financial viability, and improve our chances of continuing the service properly, respectfully, and productively. Need a new studio? Please get in touch with me. Call me here at the studio, or go to the send a message to FRSC at freakradio.org if you have any suggestions or ideas. Now think, folks. We need a new studio. Okay, now for real. Here's the article from the Undaunted Dove. Shalom, salam, peace. Reports of the Middle East Cluster by Margaret Knight. Conflict between Jews and Arabs is fairly recent. For centuries, Jews were persecuted in Christian Europe and found sanctuary in Arab lands. According to Islamic law, Jews and Christians are protected peoples allowed to live in their own communities under their own laws. When the British took over Palestine in 1922, I believe it was actually 1920, the population was about 78% Muslim, 11% Jewish, and 10% Christian. In February 1919, British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour wrote Walter Rothschild, member of the Rothschild banking family and the leading Zionist in Great Britain, saying Britain favored a Jewish homeland in Palestine, reading in part, provided that home can be given them without either dispossessing or oppressing the present inhabitants. Okay, that is not a quote from, that is not an exact quote from the Balfour statement, but it's a quote from Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour's letter to Walter Rothschild. Provided that home can be given them, the Jews, without either dispossessing or oppressing the present inhabitants, end quote. Writing to the British Prime Minister a few months later, Balfour wrote, quote, in Palestine we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. I do not think that Zionism will hurt the Arabs, but they will never say they want it, end quote. A generation before, in 1897, Theodor Herzl, founder of Zionism, wrote of a future Zionist state, we shall try to spirit the penniless population of Palestine across the border by procuring employment for them in the transit countries while denying any employment in our country. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly, end quote. This seems to be the first enunciation of the transfer policy. David Ben-Gurion, first Prime Minister of Israel, wrote in 1937, and I quote, we must expel the Arabs and take their places, and if we have to use force to guarantee our own right to settle in those places, then we have force at our disposal, end quote. And again, quote, I support compulsory transfer. I do not see in it anything immoral. The Arabs will have to go, but one needs an opportune moment for making it happen, such as a war, end quote. Again, this is from an article written by Ms. Margaret Knight in a newsletter put out by the Santa Cruz, California chapter of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the most recent issue. Returning to her article. Nor did the United Nations consult the Arabs in 1947 when it partitioned Palestine and created the State of Israel. Today, the total Jewish and Arab populations of Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and Syria's Golan Heights are nearly equal. I think she means the proportion of Jews to Arabs. Should the solution to the Arab problem be one state where Jews will soon be a minority, or two states? In 2011, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said, I have no wish to annex them, Arabs, into Israel. I want to separate from them so that they will not be Israeli citizens. I am interested that there will be a solid Jewish majority inside the State of Israel. End quote. In retaliation to UN recognition of Palestine as a non-member observer state, Netanyahu authorized 3,000 new housing units on Palestinian land between Jerusalem and the large settlements of Mahale Adumim. This would extend Israeli control of the Jordan Valley. This would extend Israeli control to the Jordan Valley from Jerusalem, almost bisecting the West Bank. Netanyahu rejects a one-state solution, but makes a contiguous Palestinian state almost impossible. Thank you, Margaret Knight. I'm glad I read that, because I've read Margaret's articles before, and I had been under the impression, slightly, that her articles tend to say the same things over and over. But no, she's a smart lady, and she does her homework. It's 4:35 here in California. Mideast Madness comes to you at 3 p.m. every Monday on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're at 101.3 FM streaming live at freakradio.org. You've heard me introduce myself as a Palestinian American. I have visited the homeland, part of it. The land that my late father was never able to return to. So he made a life for himself here in the United States, met my lovely mother, and raised a family of four children. The three girls and me. At any rate, you know that I don't deny my sentiment for the Palestinian cause, the cause of Palestine. No one is calling me to make corrections to what I'm saying, so I must be absolutely right about everything. I must be God. God on your radio set, coming to you from Free Radio, isn't that something? And I'm out there on the streets with my sandwich board, engaging people in constructive, friendly discussion, doing what I can to raise the profile of the Middle East conflict in hopes of putting an end to it. Many believe, coming from a variety of positions, that the conflict between Israel and Palestine, between Jews and Arabs, will be the undoing of the world, will signal the end of the world. There are the so-called Christian Zionists who are counting on it. Their agenda is for all the Jews of Israel and all the Jews of the world to eventually come to Jesus Christ and forge a personal relationship with Jesus. In other words, to become fundamentalist Christians. They see the predominance of the Israeli Jews and of Zionism, whether or not they use that word, Zionism or Zion, as the key to a post-Armageddon renewed world where God reigns for 1,000 years. That's my understanding of it, anyway. Do you accept that explanation? Or is it far more pragmatic to simply say, this is what's going on? Religious zealots and heretics will grab onto it and make their interpretations. And this is what will come of it, no matter what anyone does. Is that the way we think in the 21st century? I am trying to get people to think. With this show and with my show behind the inside the sandwich board on the streets of Santa Cruz. Chuck Hagel's been in the news. I've read this before, but since mainstream media, some of them anyway, are finally addressing the situation. See, President Barack Obama wants to, in the beginning of his, or towards the beginning of his impending January 20th inauguration of a second term, Obama wants to appoint former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, H-A-G-E-L, of Nebraska, as the new Secretary of Defense, who will be replacing Leon Panetta. Mainstream media is finally talking about this. So I'm going to read you this article regarding Mr. Hagel, written by M.J. Rosenberg. Repeating this, this is a rerun from last week's show. I'm going to read you again M.J. Rosenberg's "The Non-Existent, Quote-Unquote, Jewish Lobby Declares War on Chuck Hagel." Mr. Rosenberg, by the way, is a former staff member of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, but now a fierce critic of that same outfit. Friday, 21 December 2012, the American Jewish Committee, get that date, folks, going back to the 21st of last month, the American Jewish Committee was the latest Jewish organization to enlist in the battle to prevent President Barack Obama from naming, former Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel to be Secretary of Defense. The onslaught is unprecedented. Never before has virtually the entire organized Jewish community combined to stop a presidential cabinet appointment because it deems the potential nominee insufficiently devoted to Israel. Of course, below the cabinet level, the lobby has been manning the barricades against critics of any Israeli government policies for decades. The onslaught against Hagel is unique, however, because the reason for it is not merely that he opposes the rush to war with Iran and favors negotiating an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The reason is because he dared to refer to the existence of the Israel lobby. He said this in 2008 in an interview with former State Department official Aaron Miller. Quote, "This Congress is an institution that does not inherently bring out a great deal of courage. Most of the time, members play it safe and adopt an I'll support Israel attitude. AIPAC comes knocking with a pro-Israel letter and, quote, then you'll get 80 to 90 senators on it. I don't think I've ever signed one of those letters." Continuing the broad quotation, when someone would accuse him of... Okay, no. Just, end quote. When someone would accuse him of not being pro-Israel because he didn't sign the letter, Hagel told me, he responds, "I didn't sign the letter because it was a stupid letter." Few legislators talk this way on the Hill. Hagel is a strong supporter of Israel and a believer in shared values. The Jewish lobby intimidates a lot of people up here, but as he put it, "I'm a United States senator. I'm not a senator. I'm not an Israeli senator." That quote will likely doom Hagel's candidacy because if there is one institution that is considered untouchable, it is the Israel lobby and its power. Here's Wall Street Journal columnist Brett Stevens, or Steffens, a major neocon and Netanyahu supporter, on the implications of Hagel's remarks. "Prejudice, like cooking, wine tasting, and other consummations, has an olfactory element. When Chuck Hagel, the former Grand Old Party senator from Nebraska, who is now a front runner to be the next Secretary of Defense, carries on about how, quote, the Jewish lobby intimidates a lot of people up here, end quote. The odor is especially ripe. Right, because the Jewish lobby, as far as I'm aware, doesn't exist. No lesser authorities on the subject than John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt. Stephen. Authors of The Israel Lobby have insisted the term Jewish lobby is, quote, inaccurate and misleading, both because the Israel lobby includes non-Jews, like Christian Zionists, and because many Jewish Americans do not support the hardline policies favored by its most powerful elements, end quote. Right, because the word intimidates ascribes to the so-called Jewish lobby powers that are at once vast, invisible, and malevolent. And because it suggests that legislators who adopt positions friendly to that lobby are doing so not from political conviction, but out of personal fear. Just what does that Jewish lobby have on them? In short, Hegel is an anti-Semite because he stated that the, quote, Jewish lobby, end quote, both exists and intimidates. It is true that it is impolitic to use the term Jewish lobby rather than Israel lobby, although the very same people criticizing Hegel for using the former term, Jewish lobby, objected just as vehemently when Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer used the latter, Israel lobby, in their book on the subject. Indeed, made it the title. In any case, the term Jewish lobby is accurate when one refers to organizations like the American Jewish Committee or the Anti-Defamation League, etc. They are Jewish organizations and not AIPAC, which is the registered Israel lobby. As for the non-Jews and Christian Zionists that are supposedly part of the lobby, that is just silly, says Mr. Rosenberg in this article. Having worked on Capitol Hill for 20 years, I can attest to the fact that the only voices that matter in Washington on this issue comes from Jews. The lobby contributes millions of dollars to candidates based on its determination of his or her devotion of Israel. No non-Jewish organization does that. The whole Christian Zionist thing is a joke, and will be until John Hagee's Christians United for Israel starts pouring money into our campaigns and to both parties. Of course, the irony about the war on Hegel is that it has been launched against him because he says that the lobby acts as one to intimidate policymakers and legislators, and the lobby screams that there is no such thing as an organized lobby that does these things. Here is a list, though not comprehensive, of those who have enlisted in the campaign against Chuck Hegel: the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, Commentary, I believe that's a magazine, the Republican Jewish Coalition, the National Jewish Democratic Council, the Israel Project, the Zionist Organization of America, plus Bill Kristol, the author, columnist, Jennifer Rubin, Fred Hyatt of the Washington Post, and Ed Koch. I presume they're referring to former New York City Mayor Ed Koch. This list is only partial. Virtually all Jewish organizations, politicians, and media figures are under pressure to condemn Hegel, and many of them will. To its credit, J Street is supporting Hegel and Israel Policy Forum has long been in the Hegel camp. It honored him for his support for Israel security in 2008. But the others are all marching in lockstep to destroy a senator, a war hero, highly decorated Marine, and one of the most thoughtful public officials on foreign policy matters. I say destroy because the charge of anti-Semitism can and does destroy. If Obama decides not to pick Hagel, and he probably will so decide not to pick him, this great American will be tarred forever by the charge. The charge of anti-Semitism. The good news is that the lobby will be shown to be precisely what its critics say it is. It is an organized machine dedicated to the interest of the Israeli right that uses its power to ensure that no one in our government ever challenges Israel's government on anything. Of course, it is unlikely that the media will even report the story. But you hear it here, folks. Continuing. In the wake of last week's horrors in Connecticut, the media is talking about talking almost endlessly about the sickening power of the gun lobby. But the gun lobby doesn't come close to AIPAC's power to intimidate. After all, as I said, everyone discusses the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and what should be done about it. Virtually no one in the media discusses the Israel lobby. If Hagel is rejected by Obama, don't expect David Gregory, Rachel Maddow, or any of the rest of them to explain why. They can't. They are afraid. But they are not afraid of the NRA. Doesn't that tell you something? Fortunately, there is a blogosphere. Again, most of the major bloggers are intimidated into silence on the lobby, but not all. Where the most prominent voice of all, former New Republic editor Andrew Sullivan, does have the guts to speak out. He says, like a kabuki dance, here it comes. The usual vile insinuations. The usual call for the greater Israel lobby to kill a nomination because a U.S. senator actually believes his job is to care first about the security and interest of the U.S., not greater Israel. The reflexive equation of opposition to the Netanyahu administration or the settlements or the Gaza wars with pure bigotry. The phrases, the odor is especially ripe, are as preeningly self-righteous as they are toxic. You are not allowed, for example, to note that well-financed, organized Washington lobbies intimidate lawmakers. And then there's a colon, and then the rest of this quote is Mr. Rosenberg puts in italics. The word intimidates ascribes to the so-called Jewish lobby powers that are at once vast, invisible, and malevolent. And because it suggests that legislators who adopt positions friendly to that lobby are doing so not from political conviction but out of personal fear. Returning to the normal straight up and down font. I believe that's the end of the quote from Andrew Sullivan. It's interesting to read this familiar, exhausted, ridiculous whine in the context of our current discussion about the NRA. The NRA is routinely called the gun lobby, and it is described in exactly the same terms as AIPAC, vast, invisible, and malevolent. Because it is precisely as effective and relentless and as fanatical as AIPAC in wielding money, networking, and political pressure in attaining its legislative goals. But we are forbidden from calling AIPAC what it is the way we call the NRA what it is, because telling the truth about it has been stigmatized as anti-Semitism. It's a useful ruse for bullies like the greater Israeli lobby. It's also an insult to those who have suffered and been murdered by actual anti-Semites. But for utopian fanatics, if casually calling honorable public servants anti-Semites helps them retain their dream of greater Israel, so be it. which is why the president, if indeed he is contemplating an appointment for the Nebraska Republican, should not listen to the AIPAC thugs. He should what is right for this country and not any others. Sullivan leaves out one thing. The Israel lobby is bad for the Jews. It suggests that Jewish Americans put the interests of a foreign country first, which is a damnable lie. As every poll shows, Jewish Americans not only don't vote based on Israel, they are not overly Israel-centered at all. Moreover, those of us who do deeply care about Israel, although not more than we care about our own country, believe that the best way to support Israel is to work for peace with the Palestinians and to oppose war with Iran, just as Hegel does. The lobby knows that, but it has higher goals, making our government tremble. Supporting Benjamin Netanyahu and scaring Jews into donating more money to their respective organizations. In short, the lobby is bad for America, but it's worse for Jews. Mr. Rosenberg ends his article with this sentence: how dare these hacks and lobbyists jeopardize our future in the best home Jews have ever had, namely the United States of America. Written by M.J. Rosenberg. It's an item from an internet blog written by M.J. Rosenberg. His address is in Washington, D.C. Folks, we're a minute late in closing. This is Wren. That's Wren Tawil, T as in Tom, A-W-I-L. Wren as in Lawrence. Signing off for now. See you next Monday at 3 p.m. Keep those phone numbers written on pads where you could reach them when you want to call me next week. Don't forget to donate to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Next is Palestine Today, Week in Review.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the Internet.